Well, the topic that was announced, this information and the Gulf War, is actually a bit narrow. I'd like to suggest a somewhat broader context for looking at that particular issue. The context actually has to do with what kind of a world and what kind of a society we want to look at, live in, and in particular, in what sense of democracy do we want this to be a democratic society. Let me begin by counterposing two different conceptions of democracy. One conception of democracy has it that a democratic society is one in which the public has the means to participate in some meaningful way in management of their own affairs, and the means of information are in fact open and free. If you look up democracy in the dictionary, you'll get a definition, something like that. An alternative conception of democracy is that the public must be barred from management of their own affairs, and the medium and the means of information must be kept narrowly and rigidly controlled. Now, that may sound like an odd conception of democracy, but it's important to understand that it is the prevailing conception, and in fact it long has been, not just in operation, but even in theory. There's a long history that goes back to the earliest modern democratic revolutions in 17th century England, which largely expresses this point of view. I'm just going to keep to the modern period. Let's begin with the first modern government propaganda operation. That was under the Woodrow Wilson administration. Woodrow Wilson was elected president in 1916 on the platform Peace Without Victory. That was right in the middle of the First World War. The population was extremely pacifistic, saw no reason to become involved in a European war. The Wilson administration was committed to war and had to do something about it. They established a government propaganda commission called the Creel Commission, which succeeded within 6 months in turning a pacifistic population into a hysterical, warmongering population, which wanted to destroy everything German, tear the Germans limb from limb, go to war, and save the world. That was a major achievement, and it led to a further achievement. Right at that time and after the war, the same techniques were used to whip up a hysterical Red Scare, it was called, which succeeded in pretty much destroying unions, eliminating such dangerous problems as freedom of the press and freedom of political thought. There was very strong support from the media, from the business establishment, which in fact organized and pushed much of this work, and it was in general a great success. Among those who participated and participated actively and enthusiastically were the progressive intellectuals, people of the John Dewey Circle, who took great pride in, as you can see from their own writings at the time, as they take pride in having shown that what they called the more intelligent members of the community, namely them, were able to drive a reluctant population into a war which that population didn't want by terrifying them and eliciting jingoist fanaticism and so on. The means that were used were extensive. For example, there was a good deal of fabrication of atrocities by the Huns, Belgian babies with their arms torn off, all sorts of awful things that you still read in history books. They were all invented by the British propaganda ministries, whose own commitment at the time, as they put it in their secret deliberations, was to control the thought of all the world. But crucially, they wanted to control the thought of the more intelligent members of the community in the United States, who would then disseminate the propaganda that they were concocting and convert the pacifistic country to wartime hysteria. And that worked very well. And it taught a lesson. The lesson that it taught was that state propaganda, when supported by the educated classes, and when no deviation is permitted from it, can have a big effect. It was a lesson learned by Hitler, it's learned by many others, and it has been pursued to this day. One of the groups that learned the lesson, naturally, was the business community. There had already been a public relations industry in the United States. The United States pioneered in the public relations industry. Its commitment was to control the public mind, as its leaders put it. They learned a lot from the successes of the Creel Commission and the successes in creating the Red Scare and its aftermath. And in fact, the public relations industry underwent a huge expansion at that time. It did succeed for some time in creating almost total subordination of the public to the to business rule through the 1920s. This was extreme, so extreme that congressional committees, the La Follette Committee, began to investigate it as we moved into the 1930s, which is where a lot of our information about it comes from. Now, another group that was impressed by these successes was liberal democratic theorists and leading media figures, like, for example, Walter Lippmann, who was the dean of American journalists, major foreign policy and domestic critic, and also a major theorist of liberal democracy. If you take a look at his collected essays, you'll see that they're subtitled something like progressive theory of liberal democratic thought or something like that. Lippmann was involved in these propaganda commissions and recognized their achievements. He argued that what was happening was that there was what he called a revolution in the art of democracy. Namely, it was now possible to manufacture consent, that is, to bring about agreement on the part of the public to things that they didn't want by the new techniques of propaganda. He thought also that this was a good idea, in fact, necessary. It was necessary because, as he put it, the common interests elude public opinion entirely, and they can only be understood and managed by a specialized class of responsible men who are smart enough to figure things out. So a relatively small elite, the most intelligent men of the community that the Deweyites were talking about, they can understand the common interests, what all of us care about, but these things elude the general public. This is a view that goes way back, hundreds of years. It's also a typical Leninist view. In fact, it has very close resemblance to the Leninist conception that a vanguard of revolutionary intellectuals should take state power using popular revolutions as the force that brings them to state power, and then drive the stupid masses towards a future that they're too dumb and incompetent to envision for themselves. The liberal democratic theory and Marxism-Leninism are very close in their common ideological assumptions. I think that's one reason why people have found it so easy over the years to shift from one position to another without any particular sense of change. It's just a matter of assessing where power is. You know, maybe there'll be a popular revolution and that'll put us into state power, or maybe there won't be, in which case we'll just work for the people with real power, the business community, but we'll do the same thing. We'll drive the stupid masses towards a world that they're too dumb to understand for themselves. Well, Lippmann backed this up by a pretty elaborated theory of progressive democracy. He argued that in a democracy, there are two classes, in a properly functioning democracy, there's two classes of citizens. There is, first of all, the class of citizens who have to take some active role in running the affairs of the general affairs. That's the specialized class. They're the people who analyze, who execute, make decisions, sort of run things in the political system, in the economic system, and in the ideological system. That's a small percentage of the population. Anyone who puts these ideas forth is always part of that small group, naturally. And they're talking about, you know, what we do about those others. The others who are out of this small group, the big majority of the population, they're what Lippmann called the bewildered herd. And we have to protect ourselves from the trampling and the rage of the bewildered herd. Now, there are two functions now in a democracy. Then the specialized class, the responsible men, they carry out the executive function, which means they do the thinking and the planning and, you know, understand the common interests. And then the bewildered herd, they have a function in a democracy too. Their function in a democracy, he said, is to be spectators, not participants in action. But they have more of a function than that because it's a democracy. They are allowed to lend their weight occasionally to one or another member of the specialized class. In other words, they're allowed to say, we want you to be our leader, or we want you to be our leader. That's because it's a democracy, not a totalitarian state. That's called an election. But once they've lent their weight to one or another member of the specialized class, they're supposed to sink back and become spectators of action, but not participants. That's in a properly functioning democracy. And there's a logic behind it. There's even a kind of compelling moral principle behind it. The compelling moral principle is that the mass of the public is just too stupid to be able to understand things. If they get their hand, if they try to participate in managing their own affairs, they're just going to cause trouble. And therefore, it would be immoral and improper to permit them to do this. We have to tame the bewildered herd, not allow the bewildered herd to rage and trample and destroy things. It's pretty much the same logic that says that it would be improper to let a three-year-old run across the street. You don't give a three-year-old that kind of freedom because the three-year-old doesn't know how to handle that freedom. And correspondingly, you don't allow the bewildered herd to become participants in action. They'll just cause trouble. So we need something to tame the bewildered herd, and that something is this new revolution in the art of democracy, the manufacture of consent. The media, the schools, the popular culture has to divide for the political class, the decision makers. It has to give them some tolerable sense of reality, although it also has to instill the proper beliefs, because remember, there is an unstated premise here. The unstated premise, and even the responsible men have to disguise this from themselves, the unstated premise has to do with the question of how they get into the position where they have the authority to make decisions. And the way they do that, of course, is by serving people with real power. And the people with real power are the ones who own the society, which is a pretty narrow group. And if the specialized class can come along and say, I can serve your interests, then they'll be part of the executive group. You've got to keep that quiet. And that means they have to have instilled in them the beliefs and the doctrines that will serve the interests of private power. Unless they can master that skill, they're not part of the specialized class. So we have one kind of educational system directed to the responsible men, the specialized class. They have to be deeply indoctrinated in the values and the interests of private power, and the state corporate nexus that's closely linked that represents it. And if they can get through that, they can be part of the specialized class. For the rest, the bewildered herd, they just have to be basically distracted. Turn their attention to something else, keep them out of trouble, make sure that they remain at most spectators of action, occasionally lending their weight to one or another of the real leaders who they're allowed to, who they may select among. That point of view has been developed by lots and lots of other people. In fact, it's pretty conventional. So, for example, the leading contemporary modern theologian and also foreign policy critic, Reinhold Niebuhr, sometimes called the theologian of the establishment, the guru of George Kennan and the Kennedy intellectuals and others. The way he put it was that rationality is a very narrowly restricted skill. Only a small number of people have it. Most people are guided by just emotion and impulse. And those of us, of course, us who have rationality, we have to create necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications to keep the naive simpletons more or less on course. This became a substantial part of contemporary political science. The founder of the modern field of communications, one of the leading American political scientists, Harold Laswell, he explained a couple of years after this that this is all in the 1920s, the early 1930s, that he explained that we should not succumb to what he called democratic dogmatisms about men being the best judges of their own interests, because they're not. They're not the best judges of their own interests. We're the best judges of their interests. And we have to, therefore, just out of ordinary morality, make sure that they don't have an opportunity to opt to act on the basis of their misjudgments. And the way we, in a totalitarian, what is nowadays called a totalitarian state, then a military state or something, it's easy. You just hold a bludgeon over their heads, and if they get out of line, you smash them over the head. But as societies become more free and democratic, you lose that capacity, and therefore you have to turn to the techniques of propaganda. The logic is clear. Propaganda is to a democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state. And that's wise and good because, again, the common interests elude the bewildered herd. They can't figure them out. The public relations industry not only took this ideology on very explicitly, but also acted on it. That's a huge industry, spending hundreds of, by now, probably something on the order of $1 billion a year or something. And its commitment all along was to controlling the public mind. Now, in the 1930s, big problems arose again, as they had during the First World War. It was a huge depression. There was substantial labor organizing. In fact, in 1935, labor won its first major legislative victory, namely the right to organize with the Wagner Act. And that raised two serious problems. For one thing, democracy was misfunctioning. The bewildered herd was actually winning legislative victories, and it's not supposed to work that way. The other problem was that it was becoming possible for people to organize. And people have to be atomized and separated and alone. They're not supposed to organize because then they might be able to actually exert some, they might be something beyond spectators of action. They might actually be participants if many people with limited resources could get together to enter the political arena. That's really threatening. And a major response was taken on the part of business to ensure that this would be the last legislative victory for labor, and that it would be the beginning of the end of this democratic deviation of popular organization. And in fact, it worked. That was the last legislative victory for labor. And from that point on, although the number of people in the unions, in fact, increased for a while during the Second World War, it then started dropping, the capacity to act through the unions began a steady drop. And it wasn't by accident. We're now talking about the business community, which spends lots and lots of money and attention and thought into how to deal with these problems through the public relations industry and other organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers and the Business Roundtable these days and so on. They set to work immediately to try to find a way to counter these democratic deviations. The first major effort, the first trial was a year later in 1936. There was a major strike, the Bethlehem Steel Strike out in western Pennsylvania at Johnstown, the Mohawk Valley. And business tried out a new technique of destruction of labor, which worked very well. It was not through goon squads and breaking knees and all that kind of business. That wasn't working very well anymore, but through the more subtle and effective means of propaganda. The idea was to figure out ways to turn the public against the strikers, to present the strikers as disruptive, harmful to the public, against the common interests. And the common interests are those of us, you know, the businessman, the worker, the housewife, and so on. That's all us. And we want to be just together. We want to have things like harmony and Americanism and working together and so on. And then there's those bad strikers out there who are kind of disruptive and causing trouble and breaking harmony and violating Americanism. And we got to stop them so we can all live together, you know, the corporate executive and the guy who cleans the floors who all have the same interests. We can all work together and work for Americanism in harmony, liking each other. That was essentially the message. And it was a huge amount of effort was put into presenting it. recall, after all, this is the business community, so they control the media and they have massive resources and so on, and it worked. It worked very effectively. In fact, it was later called the Mohawk Valley Formula, applied over and over again to break that strike, and these were called scientific methods of strike breaking, and they worked very effectively. Mobilized community opinion in favor of vapid, empty concepts like Americanism, who can be against that, or harmony, who can be against that, or to bring it up to date, support our troops, who can be against that, or yellow ribbons, who can be against that. Anything that's totally vacuous, you know, and that diverts, and after all, what does it mean to be in favor of, what does it mean to, so if somebody asks you, do you support the people in Iowa? I mean, can you say, yeah, I support them, or no, I don't support them? I mean, it's not even a question. It doesn't even mean anything. And that's the point. The point of public relations slogans like support our troops is that they don't mean anything. They mean as much as whether you support the people in Iowa. Of course, there was an issue. The issue was, do you support our policy? But you don't want people to think about the issue. That's the whole point of good propaganda. You want to create a slogan that nobody's going to be against, and I suppose everybody will be for, because nobody knows what it means, because it doesn't mean anything. But its crucial value is it diverts your attention from a question that does mean something. Do you support our policy? And that's the one you're not allowed to talk about. So you have people arguing about, do I support the troops? Of course I don't not support them, and so on. And then you've won. That's like Americanism and harmony. We're all together, empty slogans. Let's somehow join in them. Let's make sure that we don't have these bad people around who disrupt all of our harmony with their talk about class struggle and their rights and that sort of business. Well, that's all very effective. It runs right up to today. And of course, it is carefully thought out. You know, the people in the public relations industry aren't there for the fun of it. They're doing work. They're trying to instill the right values. In fact, they have a conception of what a democracy ought to be. It ought to be a system in which the specialized class are trained in order to do their work for the service of the masters, the people who own the society, and the rest of the population ought to be deprived of any form of organization, because organization just causes trouble. They ought to be sitting alone in front of the television set and having drilled into their heads daily the message which says the only value in life is to have more commodities, or to live like that rich middle-class family you're watching, and to have nice values like harmony and Americanism. And that's all there is in life. You may think in your own head that there's got to be something more in life than this, but since you're watching the tube alone, you assume I must be crazy, because that's all that's going on over there. And since there is no organization permitted, that's absolutely crucial, you never have a way of finding out whether you're crazy. And you just assume it, because it's the natural thing to assume. So that's the ideal, and great efforts are made into trying to achieve that ideal, and there is a certain conception of democracy behind it. The conception of democracy is the one that I mentioned. The bewildered herd are a problem. We've got to prevent their rage and trampling. We've got to distract them. They should be watching the Super Bowl or sitcoms or, violent movies or something. Every once in a while you call on them to chant meaningless slogans like support our troops, you got to keep them pretty scared, because unless they're scared properly and frightened of all kind of devils that are going to destroy them from outside, or inside or somewhere, they may start to think, which is very dangerous because they're not competent to think. And therefore it's important to distract them and marginalize them. Well, that's a conception of democracy. And in fact, going back to the business community, the last legal victory for labor really was 1935, the Wagner Act. After the war came the decline of unions, and in fact of a very rich working class culture that was associated with the unions that was destroyed. We did move to a business-run society at a remarkable level. This is the only state capitalist society, industrial society, which doesn't have even the normal social contract that you find in comparable societies. So outside of South Africa, I guess, this is the only industrial society that doesn't even have national health care, that where there's no general commitment, even minimal standards of survival for the parts of the population that can't follow those rules and gain things for themselves individually. Unions are virtually non-existent. Other forms of popular structure are virtually non-existent. There's no political parties, no political organizations. It's a long way towards, not totally, but a long way towards the ideal, at least structurally. The media are a corporate monopoly, basically have the same point of view. The two parties or two factions of the business party, most of the population doesn't even bother voting because it looks meaningless. They're marginalized and properly distracted. At least that's the goal. The leading figure in the public relations industry, Edward Bernays, actually came out of the Creel Commission. He was part of it, learned his lessons there, went on to develop what he described as engineering of consent, which he described as the essence of democracy. And of course, the people who are able to engineer consent are the ones who have the resources and the power to do it, the business community, and that's who you work for. It is also necessary to whip up the population in support of foreign adventures. Usually the population is pacifistic, just like they were during the First World War. Sees no reason to get involved in foreign adventures and killing and torture and all that sort of thing. So you have to whip them up, and to whip them up, you have to frighten them. Bernays himself had an important achievement in this respect. He was the person who ran the public relations campaign for the United Fruit Company in 1954, when the U.S. moved in to overthrow the capitalist democratic government of Guatemala and installed a murderous death squad society, which remains that way to the present day with constant infusions of U.S. aid to prevent the democratic deviation that had taken place there. With regard to domestic programs, it's necessary to constantly ram through domestic programs to which the public is opposed, because there's no reason for the public to be in favor of domestic programs which are harmful to most of the public, and that too takes extensive propaganda. We've seen a lot of it in the last 10 years. The public for the Reagan programs were overwhelmingly unpopular. Even the people who voted for Reagan, by about 3-2, hoped that his policies would not be enacted. If you take particular programs like, you know, armaments or cutting back on social spending and so on, almost every one of them was overwhelmingly opposed by the public. But as long as the public is marginalized and distracted and has no way to organize or to articulate its sentiments or even to know that you have these sentiments. I mean, the people who said, "I'd prefer social spending to military spending," people who gave that answer on polls, as people overwhelmingly did, assumed that they were the only people with that crazy idea in their heads because they never heard it from anywhere else. You know, nobody's supposed to think that. And therefore, if you do think it and you answered in a poll, you must assume, well, I'm sort of weird. That's what I think. And since there's no way to get together with other people who share that view or who will reinforce that view and help you articulate it yourself, you don't even... You know, you feel like an oddity. You feel like a kind of an oddball, so you just stay on the side and you don't pay any attention to what's going on. You look at something else, like the Super Bowl. To a certain extent, then, that ideal was achieved, but never really completely. There are institutions which it has as yet been impossible to destroy. The churches, for example, still exist, and virtually, you know, a large part of the dissident activity in the United States comes out of the churches for the simple reason that they're there. So, you know, you go to some European country and give a political talk, may very likely be in the union hall. Here that won't happen because unions, first of all, barely exist, and if they do exist, they're not political organizations. But the churches do exist, and therefore you often give a talk in a church. Central America solidarity work mostly grew out of the churches, mainly because they exist. The bewildered herd never gets properly tamed. That's one. So this is a constant battle. In the 1930s, as I say, they kind of arose again, then they're sort of put down. In the 1960s, there was another wave of dissidents. There was a name for that. It was called, by the specialized class, it was called the crisis of democracy. The crisis of democracy was regarded as entering into a crisis in the 1960s. The crisis was that large segments of the population were becoming organized and active and trying to participate in the political arena. Now, here we come back to these two conceptions of democracy. By the dictionary definition, that's an advance in democracy, but by the prevailing conception, that's a problem that has to be overcome. That's a crisis that has to be overcome. The population has to be driven back to the apathy and obedience and passivity that is their proper state, and we therefore have to do something to overcome the crisis, and great efforts were made to achieve that. It hasn't worked. I mean, the crisis of democracy is still alive and well, fortunately, but not very effective in changing policy, but certainly effective in changing opinion, contrary to what a lot of people believe. Great efforts were made after the 60s to try to reverse and overcome this malady. One aspect of the malady actually got a technical name. It was called the Vietnam Syndrome. The Vietnam Syndrome, the term that sort of began to come up around 1970, it's actually been defined occasionally. The Reaganite intellectual Norman Podhoretz defined it as the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force. And there were these sickly inhibitions against violence on the part of a large part of the public that, people didn't understand why they should go around torturing people and killing people and carpet bombing them and so on. And it's very dangerous for a population to be overcome by these sickly inhibitions, as Goebbels understood, because then there's a limit on foreign adventures. It's necessary, as the Washington Post put it the other day rather proudly, to instill in people the martial respect for the martial virtues. Now, that's important. If you want to have a violent society that uses force around the world to achieve the ends of its own domestic elites, it's necessary to have a proper appreciation of the martial virtues and none of these sickly inhibitions about using violence. So that's the Vietnam Syndrome, and it's necessary to overcome that one. It's also necessary to completely falsify history. That's another way to overcome these sickly inhibitions, to make it look as if when we attack and destroy somebody, we're really protecting ourselves and defending ourselves against major aggressors and monsters and so on. There's been a huge effort since the Vietnam War to reconstruct the history of that. Too many people got to understand what was really going on, and that was bad, and that has to be, including plenty of soldiers and a lot of young people who are involved in the peace movement and many others. And it was necessary to rearrange those bad thoughts and to restore some form of sanity, namely a recognition that whatever we do is noble and right, and if we're bombing South Vietnam, that's because we're defending South Vietnam against somebody, namely the South Vietnamese, because nobody else was there. It's what the Kennedy intellectuals called defense against internal aggression in South Vietnam. That was the phrase that Adlai Stevenson used. It's necessary to make that the official picture and the well-understood picture. And that's worked pretty well, actually. When you have total control over the media and the educational system and scholarship is conformist and so on, you can get that across. One indication of it was actually revealed in, as you came in today, I noticed a number of people, somebody was handing out copies, maybe some of you got them, of a study that was done at the University of Massachusetts on attitudes towards the current Gulf crisis, study of beliefs and attitudes and television watching. People were asked, how many Vietnamese casualties would you estimate that there were during the Vietnam War? Average response on the part of Americans today is about 100,000. Now, the official figure is about 2 million. The actual figure is probably 3 to 4 million or something like that. The people who conducted the study raised an appropriate question. They asked the question, what would we think about German political culture if, when you asked people today how many Jews died in the Holocaust, they estimated about 300,000. What would that tell us about German political culture? Well, they leave the question unanswered, but you can pursue it. What does it tell us about our culture? It tells us quite a bit. That's necessary to overcome the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force and other democratic deviations. On this particular case, it worked. And the same is true on every topic.
You are listening to Dr. Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics and philosophy at MIT, author of numerous books, including Manufacturing Consent, co-authored with Edward Herman. For a cassette copy of this talk, Threats to Our Democracy, contact the Pacifica Program Service in the 818 area code, 506-1077. That's 506-1077 in the 818 area code. We return now to Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Pick the topic you like, the Middle East, international terrorism, Central America, whatever it is, the picture of the world that's presented to the public has only the remotest relation to reality. The truth of the matter is buried under edifice after edifice of lies. It's all been a marvelous success from this point of view in deterring the threat of democracy, achieved under conditions of freedom, which is extremely interesting. It's not like a totalitarian state where it's done by force. These achievements are under conditions of freedom. If we want to understand our own society, we have to think about these facts, and they're important facts, and important for those who care about what kind of society they live in. Well, despite all of this, the dissident culture survived. It's grown. It's grown quite a lot since 1960s, in fact. In the 1960s, the dissident culture, first of all, was extremely slow in developing. There was no protest against the Indochina War until years after the United States had started bombing South Vietnam. And when it did grow, it was a very narrow dissident movement, mostly students and young people. By the 70s, that had changed considerably. Major popular movements had developed, the environmental movements, the feminist movement, the anti-nuclear movement, and others. In the 1980s, there was an even greater expansion to the solidarity movements, which is something very new and important in the history of at least American and maybe world dissidents. These were movements that not only protested, but actually involved themselves in the intimately often in the lives of suffering people elsewhere, learned a great deal from it, had quite a civilizing effect in the United States, right in mainstream America. And all of that has made a very large difference. Anyone who's been involved in this kind of activity for many years must be aware of this. I mean, I know myself that the kind of talks that I give today in the most reactionary parts of the country, you know, central Georgia, eastern Kentucky, or anywhere you like, these are talks of the kind that I couldn't have given at the peak of the peace movement to the most, to the most active peace movement audience. And now you can give them anywhere. People may agree or may they not agree, but at least they understand what you're talking about, and there's some sort of common ground that you can pursue. Well, that's all signs of a civilizing effect. Despite all the propaganda, despite all the efforts at thought control and manufacture of consent, nevertheless, an ability and a willingness to think things through, skepticism about power has grown. Attitudes have changed on many, many topics and many, many issues. And it's kind of slow, maybe even glacial, but perceptible and important. Whether it's fast enough to make a significant difference in what happens in the world is another question. I mean, just to take one example of it, one familiar example of it, take the famous gender gap. In the 1960s, attitudes of men and women were approximately the same on such matters as the martial virtues and the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force. Nobody, neither men nor women, were suffering from those sickly inhibitions back in the early 60s. The responses were the same. Everybody thought that the use of violence to suppress people out there was just right. Over the years, it's changed. The sickly inhibitions have increased all across the board. But meanwhile, a gap has been growing. And by now, it's a very substantial gap. According to polls, it's something like maybe 25%. Well, what has happened? What has happened is that there is some form of at least semi-organized popular movement that women are involved in, the feminist movement. And organization has its effects. You know, it means you discover you're not alone. Others have the same thoughts that you do, and you can reinforce your thoughts, and you can learn more about what you think. You can learn more about what you believe. This is a very informal movement. It's not like a membership organization or anything. It's just, it's like a mood that spread and that involved interactions among people and so on, and it has a very noticeable effect. That's the danger of democracy. The danger of democracy is that if organizations can develop, if people are no longer just glued to the tube alone, you may have all these funny thoughts arising in their heads, like sickly inhibitions against the use of military force, and that has to be overcome, but it hasn't been overcome. Well, you can illustrate this wherever you turn. Let me finally turn to the topic. Actually, let me delay one longer. Instead of talking about the last war, let me talk about the next war, because sometimes it's useful to be prepared instead of just reacting. There are growing domestic social and economic problems, in fact, maybe catastrophes. Nobody has any idea what to do. Nobody in power, at least, has any intention of doing anything about them. If you look at the domestic programs of the administrations of the past 10 years, I include here the Democratic opposition, there's really no proposal, no serious proposal about what to do about the severe problems of health and education and homelessness and joblessness and crime and soaring criminal population, and the jails, deterioration of the inner cities. I mean, the whole raft of problems, you all know about them. They're all getting worse. Just in the 2 years George Bush has been in office, 3 million more children crossed the poverty line, the debt is zooming, the educational standards are declining, and the whole, real wages are now back to the level of about the late 50s, and nobody for about most of the population, and nobody really has any thoughts in their heads about doing anything about this. Well, in such circumstances, you've got to divert the bewildered herd, because if they start noticing all this, they may not like it, since they're the ones who are suffering from it. And just having them watch the Super Bowl and the sitcoms may not be enough. So you have to whip them up into fear of enemies. In the 1930s, Hitler whipped them into fear of the Jews and the gypsies and so on. You got to crush them to defend ourselves. Well, we have our ways too. Over the last 10 years, repeat every year or two, some major monster is constructed that we have to defend ourselves against. There used to be one that was there on the cheap. It was the Russians. You could always defend yourself against the Russians. But they're kind of losing their attractiveness as an enemy, and it's getting harder and harder to use that one, so new ones have to be conjured up. In fact, people have quite unfairly criticized George Bush for being unable to sort of express or articulate, what's really driving us now. I mean, that's very unfair. Prior to about the mid-80s, you could do it like when you were asleep. You just play the record. The Russians are coming, that's enough. But he lost that one, and he's got to make up new ones, just like the Reaganite public relations apparatus did in the 80s. So it was international terrorists and narco-traffickers and crazed Arabs and, Saddam Hussein, the new Hitler, is going to conquer the world and so on. They got to keep coming up one after another. You frighten the population, terrorize them, intimidate them so they're too afraid to travel and they're sort of cowering in fear. And then you have a magnificent victory over Grenada or Panama or something like that, or over a defenseless third world army that you can pulverize before you ever bother to look at them, like just happened, peasant army. And then everybody feels relief and, we were saved just to the last minute. That's one of the ways in which you can keep the bewildered herd from paying attention to what's really going on around them and keep them diverted and controlled. And the next one that's coming along very likely will be Cuba. That's going to require a continuation of the illegal economic warfare, probably a continuation of the extraordinary international terrorism. The major international terrorism ever has been the program organized by the Kennedy administration, first Operation Mongoose, then things that followed along against Cuba. There's nothing remotely comparable to it, except maybe the war against Nicaragua. If you call that terrorism, the World Court classified it as something more like aggression. There's also got to be an ideological offensive, and it's all got to build up until, some other chimera monster that we have to protect ourselves again, and then if you can ensure that they're crushed, You know, you can't go in if they can fight back. That's much too dangerous. But if you can assure that they're crushed, maybe we'll sort of knock that one off and feel another sigh of relief. Well, this has been going on for a while, in fact. In fact, in May 1986, that is when the memoirs of a released Cuban prisoner came out, Armando Valladares, and they quickly became a media sensation. I'll give you a couple of quotes. The media described his revelations as the definitive account of the vast system of torture and prison by which Castro punishes and obliterates political opposition. It was an inspiring and unforgettable account of the bestial prisons, inhuman torture, record of state violence under yet another of the country's of this century's mass murderers, who we learn at last from this book has created a new despotism that has institutionalized torture as a mechanism of social control in the hell that was the Cuba that Valladares lived in. Now, that's all Washington Post and New York Times in repeated reviews. Castro was described as a dictatorial goon. His atrocities were revealed in this book so conclusively that only the most light-headed and cold-blooded Western intellectual will come to the tyrant's defense, Washington Post. This, remember, is a description of one man's account of what happened to him. Let's say it's all true, okay? Let's raise no questions about the question of what happened to one man who says, I was tortured. He was singled out for his courage in enduring the horrors and the sadism of this bloody Cuban tyrant by Ronald Reagan at a White House ceremony marking Human Rights Day. He was then appointed the U.S. representative at the UN Human Rights Commission, where he's been able to perform signal services defending the Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments against charges that they conduct atrocity so massive that he makes anything that he suffered look pretty minor, and that's the way things stand. Well, that was May 1986. The month is interesting, and it tells you something about manufacture of consent. In May 1986, the same months, the surviving members of the human rights group of El Salvador, several of the leaders had been killed, the surviving members were arrested and tortured, including Herbert Anaya, who was the director. They were sent to a prison, La Esperanza Hope Prison. And while they were in the prison, they continued their human rights work. Their lawyers and that sort of thing. They continued taking affidavits. There were 432 prisoners in that prison. They got signed affidavits from 430 of them, in which they described under oath the torture that they had received, electrical torture, other atrocities, including in one case torture by a North American U.S. major in uniform, who's described in some detail. This is an unusually explicit and comprehensive testimony, probably unique in its detail about what's going on in a torture chamber. It was actually a 160-page report of the sworn testimony of these prisoners was sneaked out of the prison, along with a videotape which was taken showing people testifying in prison about their torture. It was distributed by the Marin County Interfaith Task Force. The national press refused to cover it. The television stations refused to run it. There was an article in the local Marin County newspaper, San Francisco Examiner had an article. I think that's all. Nobody else would touch it. This was a time when there were more than a few lightheaded and cold-blooded Western intellectuals who were singing the praises of José Napoleón Duarte and of Ronald Reagan. Anaya was not the subject of any tributes. He didn't get on Human Rights Day. He wasn't appointed to anything. Rather, he was released in a prisoner exchange and then assassinated, presumed apparently by the U.S.-backed security forces. Very little information about that ever appeared, and the media never asked whether exposure of the atrocities, instead of sitting on them and silencing them, might say have saved his life. Well, that tells you something about the way a well-functioning system of manufacture of consent works in comparison with the revelations of the one prison in El Salvador. Valladares's memoirs are not a picnic on a mountain, even, but you've got your job to do. Well, that takes us toward the next war. We're going to hear more and more of this, I suspect, until the next operation takes place. Well, a few remarks about the last one. Let's turn finally to that. Let me begin, in fact, with this University of Massachusetts study that was some of you had distributed that I mentioned before. It has some interesting conclusions. People are asked whether they think that the United States should use force, should intervene with force, to reverse illegal occupation or serious human rights abuses. And by about 2-1, people in the United States think we should. We should use force in the case of illegal occupation of land and severe human rights abuses. Well, if the United States was to follow that advice, we would bomb El Salvador, Guatemala, Indonesia, Damascus, Tel Aviv, Cape Town, Turkey, Washington, and a whole list of other states. In fact, whatever atrocities, you know, these are all cases of just illegal occupation and aggression. If we talk about human rights and severe human rights abuses, if you know the facts about that range of examples, which is no time to run through, you will know very well that Saddam Hussein's aggression and atrocities fall well within the range. They're not the most extreme. They're well within that range. Now, why doesn't anybody conclude that? Well, the reason nobody concludes it is because nobody knows. In a well-functioning propaganda system, nobody would know what I'm talking about when I list that range of examples. You wouldn't, there's no time to run through it here, and if you don't know, you should. But if you bother to look, you'll find out that those examples are quite appropriate. So take one that was ominously close to being perceived right through this period. In February, right in the middle of all the of the bombing campaign, in February, the government of Lebanon requested Israel to observe UN Security Council Resolution 425, which called on it to withdraw immediately and unconditionally from Lebanon. That resolution dates from March 1978. There have since been two subsequent resolutions calling for the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of Israel from Lebanon. Of course, it doesn't observe them because the United States backs it in maintaining that occupation. Meanwhile, southern Lebanon is terrorized. There are big torture chambers with horrifying things going on. It's used as a base for attacking other parts of Lebanon. In the course of these 13 years, Lebanon was invaded. The city of Beirut was bombed. About 20,000 people were killed, about 80% of them civilians. Hospitals were destroyed. Again, more terror, looting, robbery, and so on. All fine. The United States backed it. That's just one case. You didn't see anything in the media or in any discussion about whether Israel and the United States should observe UN Security Council 425 or any of the other resolutions, nor did anyone call for the bombing of Tel Aviv. Although, by the principles upheld by two-thirds of the population, you should. After all, that's illegal occupation and severe human rights abuses. And that's just one case. There are much worse ones. The Indonesian invasion of East Timor, that knocked off about 200,000 people. They all look minor, but that was strongly backed by the United States, still going on with major U.S. diplomatic and military support, and we can go on and on. Well, that tells you how a well-functioning propaganda system works. People can believe that when we use force against Iraq and Kuwait, it's because we really observe the principle that illegal occupation and human rights abuses should be met by force. They don't see what it would mean if those principles were observed, because the world as presented to them does not include the cases in which it would apply. That's a success of propaganda of quite a spectacular type. Let's take a look at another case. If you look closely at the coverage of the war in the last, since August, the build-up to war and war, you'll notice that there are a couple of striking voices missing. For example, there is an Iraqi democratic opposition. In fact, a very courageous and quite substantial Iraqi democratic opposition. They, of course, function in exile because they couldn't survive in Iraq. They're in Europe, primarily. There are bankers and engineers and architects and people like that. They're articulate. They have voices. They speak. Last February, when Saddam Hussein was still George Bush's favorite friend and trading partner, They actually came to Washington, according to Iraqi Democratic Opposition sources, with a plea for some kind of support for a demand of theirs calling for a parliamentary democracy in Iraq. They were, of course, totally rebuffed because the United States had no interest in it, no reaction to this in the public record. Well, since August, it became a little harder to avoid their existence. After all, in August, we suddenly turned against Saddam Hussein after having favored him for many years. Here is this Iraqi Democratic Opposition outside who has some, ought to have some thoughts about the matter. I mean, they would be happy to see Saddam Hussein drawn and quartered. You know, he killed their brother and tortured their sister and so on and so forth, drove them out of the country. They've been fighting against his tyranny throughout the whole time that Ronald Reagan and George Bush were cherishing him. What about their voices? Well, take a look at the national media and see how much you can find about the Iraqi Democratic Opposition from August through March. Well, you can't find a word. It's not that they're inarticulate. They have statements, they have proposals, they have calls and demands. And in fact, if you look at them, you find they're indistinguishable from that of the American peace movement. They're against Saddam Hussein, and they're against the war against Iraq. They don't want the country destroyed. What they want is a peaceful resolution, and they knew perfectly well that that was achievable. That's the wrong view. Therefore, they're out. We don't hear a word about the Iraqi Democratic Opposition. You want to find out about them, read the German press or read the British press. They don't say much about them, but they're less controlled than we are. They say something. Now, that, again, is a pretty spectacular achievement of propaganda. First, that the voices of the Iraqi Democrats are completely excluded, and second, that nobody notices it. That's interesting, too. It takes a really deeply indoctrinated population not to notice that we're not hearing the voices of the Iraqi Democratic Opposition and not asking the question why and finding out the obvious answer, because they have the wrong thoughts. They agree with the international peace movement, therefore they're out. Reasons were offered for the war. The reasons are aggressors cannot be rewarded, and aggression must be reversed by the quick resort to violence. That was the reason for the war. There was basically no other reason advanced. Can that possibly be the reason for the war? Does the United States uphold those principles, that aggressors cannot be rewarded and that aggression must be reversed by a quick resort to violence? Well, I won't insult your intelligence by running through the facts, but the fact is those arguments could be refuted in 2 minutes by a literate teenager. However, they were never refuted. Take a look at the media and the, you know, the liberal commentators and the critics and the people who testified in Congress and see whether anybody questioned the assumption that the United States stands up to those principles. Has the United States opposed U.S. aggression in Panama and insisted on bombing Washington to reverse it? Has it imposed, when South African aggression, when the South African occupation of Namibia was declared illegal in 1969, did the United States impose sanctions on food and medicine? Did it go to war? Did it bomb Cape Town? No, carried out 20 years of what was called quiet diplomacy. It wasn't very pretty during those 20 years. In the years of the Reagan-Bush administration alone, about 1.5 million people were killed by South Africa just in the surrounding countries. Forget what was happening in South Africa and Namibia. Somehow that didn't sear our sensitive souls. We continued with quiet diplomacy. We ended up with ample reward for the aggressors. They were given the major port in Namibia, plenty of advantages. You took a lot of concern for their security concerns and so on. Where is this principle that we uphold? Again, it's child's play to demonstrate that those couldn't possibly have been the reasons for going to war because we don't uphold the principles, but nobody did it. That's what's important. Nobody did it. And nobody bothered to point out a conclusion that follows. No reason was given for going to war. None. No reason was given for going to war that could not be refuted, again, by a literate teenager in about 2 minutes. Now, that, again, is the hallmark of a totalitarian culture, and it ought to frighten us that we are so deeply totalitarian that you can be driven to war without any reason being given for it and with nobody noticing it or caring. It's a very striking fact. Right before the bombing started, in mid-January, about January 10th, a major poll, Washington Post ABC poll, revealed something interesting. People were asked, if Iraq would agree to withdraw from Kuwait in return for Security Council consideration of the problem of the Arab-Israeli conflict, would you be in favor of that? Okay. About two-thirds of the population was in favor of that. So was the whole world, including the Iraqi Democratic opposition. So two-thirds of the American population were in favor of that. Now, that was reported. The people who answered that question, presumably, who answered yes, we're in favor of that, presumably those people, like the ones I mentioned before, thought, each of them thought, I'm the only person in the world who thinks this, because certainly nobody in the press had said that that'd be a good idea. The orders from Washington had been, we're supposed to be against linkage, that is diplomacy, and therefore everybody goose-stepped on command, and everybody was against diplomacy. Try to find commentary in the press. I mean, you can find like a column by Alex Coburn in the Los Angeles Times, but try to find something in the press that says, yeah, that'd be a good idea. The people who were answering that question thought, I'm alone, but that's what I think. Suppose they knew that they weren't alone, that other people thought it, say, for example, the Iraqi Democratic opposition. Suppose that they knew that this was not hypothetical, that in fact Iraq had made exactly such an offer. It had been released by high U.S. officials just 10 to 8 days earlier on January 2nd. High U.S. officials had released an Iraqi offer to withdraw totally from Kuwait in return for consideration by the Security Council of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the problem of weapons of mass destruction. The United States had been refusing to negotiate that issue since well before the invasion of Kuwait. Suppose that people had known that that offer was actually on the table and that it was widely supported, and in fact that it's exactly the kind of thing that any rational person would do if they were interested in peace, as we do in other cases, if in the rare cases we do want to reverse aggression. Suppose that had been known. Well, you can make your own guesses, but I would assume that the two-thirds of the population would probably have risen to maybe 98% of the population. Well, here you have the great successes of propaganda. Nobody knew any of the things I've just mentioned. I mean, virtually no, but probably not one person who answered the poll knew any of these things. The people thought they were alone. Therefore, it was possible to proceed with the war policy without opposition. There was a good deal of discussion about whether sanctions would work. You know, you have head of the CIA coming up and you discuss whether sanctions would work. However, there was no discussion of a much more obvious question. Had sanctions already worked? You know. Well, answer is, yeah, apparently they had. Probably by late August, very likely by late December. At least it's very hard to think up any other reason for the Iraqi offers of withdrawal, which were authenticated or in some cases released by high U.S. officials who described them as serious and negotiable. So the real question is, had sanctions already worked? Was there a way out? Was there a way out right now in terms quite acceptable to the general population, the world at large, and the Iraqi Democratic opposition? Well, that question was not discussed, and it's crucial for a well-functioning propaganda system that it not be discussed. That enables the chairman of the Republican National Committee, or whatever it's called, to say that if any Democrat had been in office, Kuwait would not be liberated today. He can say that. No Democrat can get up and say, yeah, if I was president, Kuwait would have been liberated not only today, but 6 months ago, because there were opportunities then that I would have pursued and Kuwait would have been liberated without killing tens of thousands of people and without causing an environmental catastrophe. And no Democrat can say that because no Democrat took that position. I mean, no Democrat is too far, like Henry Gonzalez took it and maybe Barbara Boxer took it. But, you know, the number of people who took it were so marginal, you know, that it's virtually non-existent. Therefore, no leader of the Democratic Party can say, wait a minute, I was in favor of, if you'd followed my advice, Kuwait would have been liberated long ago, in exactly the terms that had been proposed, because I would have pursued them. Again, no environmental catastrophe, no tens of thousands of people killed, but of course, crucially, no demonstration to the world that the world is to be ruled by force, what we're good at, and you guys better get out of the way, or we're going to teach you some lessons that you'll never forget. Now, given the fact that no Democratic politician can say that, yeah, Clayton Yoder is free to make his statements. When Scud missiles hit Israel, nobody in the press applauded. Now, again, that's an interesting fact about a well-functioning propaganda system, because we might ask, why not? After all, Saddam Hussein's arguments were as good as George Bush's arguments. What were they, after all? Let's just take Lebanon. Saddam Hussein says the following. He says, look, I can't stand annexation. You know, I can't let Israel's annex the Syrian Golan Heights in opposition to the unanimous and East Jerusalem in opposition to the unanimous agreement of the Security Council. I can't stand annexation. I can't stand aggression. Israel's been occupying southern Lebanon for 13 years in violation of Security Council resolutions that it refuses to abide by. In the course of that period, it attacked all of Lebanon, still bombs most of Lebanon at will. I can't stand it. I read the Amnesty International report on Israeli atrocities in the West Bank. My heart is bleeding. I can't stand it. The sanctions can't work because the United States vetoes them. Negotiations won't work. The United States blocks them. What's left but force? I've been waiting for years, you know, 13 years in the case of Lebanon, 20 years in the case of West Bank. You've heard that argument before. The only difference between that argument and the one you heard is that Saddam Hussein could truly say sanctions can't work and negotiations can't work because the United States blocks them. But George Bush couldn't say that because sanctions apparently had worked, and there was every reason to believe that negotiations could work, except that he adamantly refused to pursue them, saying explicitly there will be no negotiations right through. Well, did you find anybody in the press who pointed that out? No, it's a triviality. It's something that, again, a literate teenager could figure out in about a minute. But nobody pointed it out, no commentator, no editorial writer. That, again, is the sign of a very well-run totalitarian culture. It shows that manufacture of consent is working. Last comment about this, we could give many examples. You can make them up as you go along. Take the idea that Saddam Hussein's a monster about to conquer the world, widely believed in the United States, and not unrealistically. It was drilled into people's heads over and over again. He's about to take everything. We got to stop him now. How did he get that powerful? You know, now this is a small third world country without an industrial base. For 8 years, Iraq had been fighting Iran. That's post-revolutionary Iran, which had decimated its officer corps and most of its military force. Iraq had a little bit of support in that war. It was backed by the Soviet Union, the United States, Europe, the major Arab countries, and the Arab oil producers. And it couldn't defeat Iran. But all of a sudden, it's ready to conquer the world. Did you find anybody to point that out? Well, the fact of the matter is, this was a third world country with a peasant army. It is now being conceded that there was a ton of disinformation about the fortifications and the chemical weapons and so on, but did you find anybody who pointed it out? No. You found nobody who pointed it out, virtually nobody who pointed it out. And that's typical. We've been through it. And notice that this was done 1 year after exactly the same thing was done with Manuel Noriega. Manuel Noriega is a minor thug by comparison with George Bush's friend Saddam Hussein, or the George Bush's other friends in Beijing, and plenty, or George Bush himself for that matter. In comparison with them, Manuel Noriega is a pretty minor thug. Bad, but you know, not by world stand, not a world-class thug of the kind we like. He was turned into a creature larger than life. He was going to destroy us, leading the narco traffickers. We had to quickly move in and smash him, you know, killing a couple hundred or maybe 1,000 people, restoring in power the tiny, maybe 8% white oligarchy, putting U.S. military officers in control at every level of the political system. We had to do all those things because we had to save ourselves. We were going to be destroyed by this monster. 1 year later, the same thing was done with Saddam Hussein. Did anybody point it out? Did anybody point out what had happened or why? You'll have to look pretty far for that. Notice that this is not all that different from what the Kuhl Commission did back in 1916 and 1917, when within 6 months, it had turned a pacifistic population into raving hysterics who wanted to destroy everything German, because we had to save ourselves from these Huns who were tearing the arms off of Belgian babies. The techniques are maybe more sophisticated, and there's more television and so on, and more money goes into it. It's pretty traditional. I think the issue, to come back to my original comment, the issue here is not simply disinformation and the Gulf crisis. The issue is much broader. It's whether we want to live in a free society or whether we want to live under what amounts to a form of self-imposed totalitarianism, with the bewildered herd marginalized, directed elsewhere, terrified, screaming patriotic slogans, fearing for their lives, admiring with awe the leader who saved them from destruction, while the educated classes goose-step on command, repeat the slogans they're supposed to repeat. The society deteriorates at home. We end up serving as a mercenary enforcer state, hoping that others are going to pay us to smash up the world. Those are the choices. And that's the choice that you have to face. And the answer to those questions is very much in the hands of people exactly like you and me.
You have been listening to Dr. Noam Chomsky, professor at MIT, author of numerous books, and contributor to Zeta magazine. For a cassette copy of this program, Threats to Our Democracy, call the Pacifica Program Service at area code 818-506-1077. That's 506-1077 in the 818. Call It Democracy is from World of Wonders by Bruce Coburn. And they call it democracy.